Hello and welcome to Crossing Channels. I'm Rory Ketlin-Jones. What's the point of a protest? That's the subject of the latest in our podcast collaboration between Cambridge University's Bennett Institute for Public Policy and the Institute for Advanced Study in Toulouse. As ever, we're going to use the interdisciplinary strengths of both institutions to explore a complex challenge. Why is the world protesting so much? How has protesting changed over the years? And what impact are mass protest movements having on policymaking? To explore these issues today, we have Lauren Wilcox from the University of Cambridge. Lauren, start us off. What does your research focus on?
Thanks, Rory. My research is on gender and race and sexuality in politics, particularly involves questions of bodies and embodiment in the political sphere and questions of violence surrounding that as well.
And joining us from the IAST, we have Felix Drvinger and Giacomo Lemoli. Felix, could you share with us your primary research interests?
Yes, hello, Rory, and thank you for having us. My research lies in the realm of comparative politics and political economy, and with a particular focus on autocratic politics and democratic backsliding.
Giacomo, what are your main research interests?
Thanks, Rory. I research the formation and changes of social cleavages and political identities, and I'm also interested in why events of the past do or do not have such historically persistent effects.
Excellent. Well, we will be looking at the past, present and future of protest over the next half hour or so. Those of us who can at least remember the 60s and 70s may find this surprising, but it seems we are protesting like never before. A recent study by Isabel Ortiz and others found that the number of protests around the world has tripled between 2006 and 2020. So what's going on? Why is the world protesting so much? Where and what about? Lauren, why don't you start us off?
I think it has to do with a growing disconnect between what our governments are doing and what our political parties can deliver for us in liberal democracies and kind of what the needs and interests of the people are. I think that has to do with it in a kind of growing disengagement with electoral politics, as well as some of the more material supports that exist in terms of things like social media and the availability for networking and finding people and organizing and that as well. That's just a couple initial thoughts.
Come in on that, Giacomo. How do you see it? I mean, first of all, do you agree with the premise that we're seeing a sort of new wave of protests?
I would say we are certainly experiencing some global trends, such as globalization trends, and big migration waves, and recently climate change. So these are all changes that bring, in some cases, deterioration in the quality of life of many people, which also leads to higher social demands and somehow dissatisfaction with political leaders. And protests are just a way that people has always had to communicate to their leaders that some change needs to be implemented. Now, to be sure, these are not things that are unique to this current period. What is perhaps unique to this period is that there is perhaps more awareness about some of the most pressing problems that our societies face. And also the informational environment is very different. So it's much easier to learn about other protests that are happening somewhere else in the world, which gives an opportunity to follow the example of others and also perhaps more confidence in the transformative capacity of protests.
And Felix, Lauren talked about this growing disconnect between people and their leaders. Do you agree with that? Can that really explain a tripling of protests, as that study showed?
There is definitely what I would have called a lack of political representation that is perceived by ordinary people. If we go back to that one piece of scholarship that you mentioned at the beginning by Ortiz et al., then they would actually come up with like three additional reasons for people to protest, which are the economic uncertainties and insecurities of our times.
Because it's interesting, isn't it, that the period covered almost exactly mirrors, the beginning of the global financial crisis and how that's played out over the last 15 years.
Yes, we are living through times of crises, and it's like the sequence of different crises As you said, it started off with a financial crisis in 2008. The Arab Spring, which was a huge mass protest, what came with it was a refugee crisis that hit the European continent as well, which led to additional fears and perceived grievances, at least, among European citizens. And in addition to that, we have climate change, which is putting pressure on our political systems. And very recent, I must say, concerning trends in international relations with like international conflicts, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but also the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. These are also matters for concern for people, which make them turn out and mobilize.
Lauren, has the nature of protest changed?
You certainly see some of them, if you're talking about, say, you know, in the United States, in the UK, and in Europe, drawing on some of the memory of these movements from the 60s, or drawing on some of these traditions for inspiration, certainly. You know, for the ways in which Black Lives Matter movements draw upon the civil rights movements, and that they're all kind of cross-pollinating with from the women's movement. But you also see different forms about this, or different ways in which they're mobilized. And social media is part of that, I think. Again, the ability to kind of, you know, to videotape, right, and to kind of broadcast live from what you're doing, to kind of make, you know, there'd be a global audience for your movement in real time, in ways that can often get around the ways in which they are either censored by the media, or you know, there might be a kind of, you know, lack of coverage in the media from.
So people are instantly aware, in a way that even in the 1960s, you know, the television era, they're instantly aware of protests, the other side of the world.
Certainly. And even some of the protest movements that might not get as much coverage, the ongoing, you know, marches for Palestine, march, you know, or movements for trans rights, for example, that are a little less frequently covered often on social media, are quite well covered as well. And so it's a kind of a way of being more instantly aware of these. And I think one of the things that's happening is that more and more people are seeing the connections between different kinds of movements as well, that they're not necessarily single issue movements, also that they're much broader, and because you know, people don't live single issue lives.
Giacomo, how do you see that? How do you see the changing nature of protest?
To some extent, the nature of protest changes all the time, because they reflect the forms of political socialization and the relevant political conflicts of the era that protesters live. What has not changed are protests themselves. So the phenomenon of protests themselves seems to be pretty much constant.
Felix, how do you see the nature of protest changing? I mean, as Giacomo says, there is a constant, you know, people on the street in 2024 look much like people on the street in the 1960s.
I agree and disagree with what has been said. A point Lauren made that I really liked was the protests of today build up on protests in the past. Achievements we've made in the past allow us, or potentially allow us, to protest even more and try to get away with even more social injustice that we're still facing these days today. And what I wanted to mention as well, in addition to all of this, is that from my particular focus as a scholar who is very interested in autocratic politics, there has been, let's say, a shift in how authoritarian autocratic regimes seem to function. So modern autocratic regimes are much more willing to actually allow protests. And one reason why this might be is that they want to give the semblance of democracy to begin with. And in addition to that, they've become much better in managing protests.
And harnessing protests on their own behalf.
To some extent on their own behalf, but also even managing protests by opponents of that very regime. So, and for that reason, in authoritarian contexts, protests are more allowed. That's just one reason why we might actually see more protests in those areas of the world these days.
Lauren, I want to look at your interest in historic protests from a feminist point of view. Feminist movements have played a fundamental role in securing women's voting rights, advocating for reproductive rights, fighting violence against women. What are the lessons of past feminist movements? What makes those kind of protests successful?
Protest movements are never just that. They are always, you know, parts of broader campaigns or forms of a variety of methods of strikes, of protests, of demonstrations and boycotts and other tactics, right, to kind of achieve certain societal aims and transformations. Things we've learned from feminist movements, or we've learned from movements for LGBTQ rights, example, is about the importance of being very broad-based in this. So we've seen, for example, in the Stonewall movement, was of course started by runaways, by people living on the street, people engaged in sex work, by Black and brown people who weren't just working on behalf of a narrow definition of gay rights, but a really broad definition of kind of liberation across a number of different areas. And it's from, say, Black women who were dissatisfied of the whiteness of feminist movements and the masculinist politics of Black power movements at the time in the 60s and 70s that created the Combahee River Collective, which gave us one of the first articulations of interlocking oppressions or intersectionality. And so these are just, you know, some really well-known movements that are about thinking about a really broad base of this. And the political science literature bears this out too, the kind of more broad-based your movement, the broader it is as a mass movement that can bring in many people, then more likely you are to be successful.
Felix and Giacomo, I want to bring you in there. When you look back at history, are there specific types of action strategies that are more effective than others in changing public opinion and, you know, changing policy? Felix?
I haven't looked so much at the history and historical record of protests, but what I know from more recent research on protests, then the first thing that comes to my mind about what makes protests successful is that protesters should coordinate on a single issue. If the protest movement is very diverse and there's a plethora of issues that are being raised by those protesters and this movement in general, then they are much more likely to fail overall as opposed to them coordinating on one single issue. Because for the regime for the government, it is more difficult to divide and rule them if they coordinate on this single issue, because otherwise the government might basically split different groups of protesters apart from one another and try to co-opt some but not others. And then protests are likely to fail.
Giacomo, what's your feeling about what works and what does not work in terms of protesters getting something done?
Yes, so I agree with Felix that having a too broad diversity of issues in protest can be detrimental to the success of protest. I would like to qualify this a bit. For political change to be successful, ultimately what you need is a broad coalition of social groups, perhaps a majoritarian coalition, who's able to back the demand for change. So in case of parliamentary democracies, in the end, you need a support of a majority of people's representatives to actually have change implemented. And so in this sense, it's important for protest movements to not to alienate social groups whose interests may be aligned with those of the protesters. Another thing that I would also say is that it's important for the success of protest not to alienate social groups who do not participate in the protest, but whose support is needed at the level of in the political sphere.
We're seeing some radical forms of protest now, particularly about climate change, damaging artworks, disrupting daily life, which cause a lot of annoyance to a lot of citizens. Are they worthwhile? Lauren, what's your view on this?
if I were advising them, I would advise them to do different things sometimes. However, I do think there's something to be said about questioning the right to public space, the ways and the rights or the, you know, absolute sanctity of public property above all else and things like that, that do kind of get brought into the conversation with such movements also. I guess I wouldn't necessarily make a moral case against it, but maybe a strategic case against it is what I'm saying.
Right. Isn't there something, and this is for all of you, something in a democracy that's actually profoundly undemocratic about protests? It inevitably involves a small minority, often from the left, but also increasingly from the right, trying to tell the majority what to do. Giacomo.
In general, I would tend to disagree in the sense that protests are an expression of political views, similar as other forms of political behavior, such as voting or lobbying or contributing to a party. And so in this sense, I think they are, in general, a good thing for democracy. So the reason why this debate about anti-democratic protest practices arises is because protest typically entails imposing costs to other sectors of societies in order to have the voice of some groups to be heard. The fact that institutions can grant the same rights of expression in public spaces to everyone and the limit to which costs can be imposed on others is a symptom of a healthy democracy. But actually, there are some types of protests that may be argued are more problematic in a democratic sense. So protests that have the goal of advocating for the exclusion of some social groups from collective institutions and from social rights, those can be more problematic. But in general, I would say this is a debate that has to do more with the forms and goals of protest than with the practice of protest by itself.
Felix, we're seeing, for instance, growing numbers of protests. Are those healthy protests or unhealthy protests?
So the first response to your question is, in principle, protests are never bad news for democracy. Second, there is a real battle for democracy in our times. Third, what I would like to point out as a last point with regards to this question is that, yes, there are far-right protests, far-right demonstrations and all this. But what we also know, and there is research on this, is that mobilization for democracy works as well. Since we are in this battle for democracy, what is important is that all those who are pro-democracy should take a stance and also consider turning out for pro-democracy protests as well. Because what we know from research is that, especially when turnout in pro-democracy demonstrations, mass demonstrations, is large, as we've seen recently in Germany, when there were protests against the so-called Alternative for for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, due to some ideas among those peoples about re-immigration of people who have come to Germany, then what we've seen there is that the in surveys, the number of people who expressed that they would still vote for the Alternative for Germany were going down immediately after those protests. And these effects are phasing out quickly, unfortunately. But if protests can be maintained, then this can help democracy as well.
Let's draw all this together and work out where protest is going next, if it's going anywhere. Giacomo, you start us off.
From what we are seeing in recent years, at least in Western societies, one trend that we are observing is that more and more young people are being involved in protest. So in some sense, the demographic profile of protest is changing. So more young people and more people from backgrounds that were not used to protest before seems to be more and more engaged. So we are seeing this with the rise of the social movements for advocating for climate policy.
Lauren, how would you sum up where we've got to with protests at the moment and potentially how it might develop.
I think we've gotten to really emphasize how important it is for our democracies that our sort of rights to protest are protected, and that the protest is not becoming criminalized. And that's something that's really core in terms of how we're thinking about protecting and strengthening democracies.
And Felix, what about you? Do you maintain your belief in the importance of protest as a viable tool for changing the world?
Yes, I do. I do uphold this position. What I would like to add is, if we ask about where the future of protest is going, then I think we can definitely say like one or two things about authoritarian contexts of protests. Namely, we will continue observing more protests in modern autocratic regimes just because they want to give this semblance of democracy and because they have managed to exploit protests, even anti-regime protests, in their favor. So by them, I mean authoritarian governments. Because the conventional wisdom we have is that protest destabilizes autocracies. And we might think of the Monday demonstrations in the former German Democratic Republic that brought down the Berlin Wall. Here we had a cascade effect where more and more people were drawn into these protests, and eventually the regime fell. Modern autocracies are very much more about information manipulation to basically signal to potential opponents of the regime that the regime is popular and there is capable of running government, and for that reason, to some extent, counterintuitively, in order to make those claims credible, the claim that they are some sort of democracy, even though it has some flaws, it's actually good news for them if there is some protest every now and then, because it shows them, given that protests are a feature of democracy, a way of making credible their claim that they are a democracy themselves. So for that reason, if there's one trend that I can point out, in future we would also see more protests in autocracies as well.
Well, that's all we have time for on this episode. Thanks to Lauren Wilcox from the University of Cambridge and Felix Dwinger and Giacomo Lemoli from the IAST. Let us know what you think of this latest episode of Season 3 of Crossing Channels. You can contact us via Twitter, as I still insist on calling it. The Bennett Institute is at Bennett Inst. The Institute for Advanced Study in Toulouse is IAS Toulouse. And I am Ruskin147. If you enjoyed this episode, then do listen to our other Crossing Channels editions, notably our latest on the impact of AI regulation on innovation. And please join us next month for the next edition, where we'll be looking at the role of colonialism today.